This is Ozarks at Large for Monday, November 19th, 2012. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Support for KUAF comes from Northwest Arkansas Media, publishers of Northwest Arkansas Times, Springdale and Rogers Morning News, Benton County Daily Record, and the Northwest Arkansas edition of the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, offering a blend of local, state, national, and international news, plus business and Razorback news. More information is available online at nwaonline.com. Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, we learn more about a rug-making project at the Boonville Human Development Center. Plus, we have sounds from this weekend's Lights of the Ozarks celebration on the Fayetteville Square. Also, we'll hear the latest installment of Arkansongs. Roby Brock from our content partner TalkBusiness.net delivers political and business news from around the state and more. But first, as part of his 2013 budget, Arkansas Governor Mike Beebe has proposed future cuts to the state's sales tax on groceries. The cuts aren't outright in next year's budget, as the governor felt it was not the right time for more cuts in the face of upcoming Medicaid cuts.
What I've done is propose a system to trigger this tax cut when future state money becomes available. The most likely source for this money would be the expected reduction or elimination of Arkansas's desegregation payments to the three central Arkansas school districts. If and when that money becomes available in the next few years, the sales tax on groceries would drop from 1.5% to 1/8%.
According to TalkBusiness.net, the cut to the grocery tax would kick in after payments from general revenue funds decline by $35 million for more than six consecutive months. Other general revenue funds besides Department of Education disbursements that would trigger the cuts to the grocery tax include payments issued under the Arkansas Water, Water Disposal, and Pollution Abatement Facilities Financing Act of 2007, payments for Arkansas College Savings Bonds, payments from the City-County Tourist Facilities Aid Fund, and payments for bonds issued under the Arkansas Higher Education Technology and Facility Improvement Act of 2005. If you want to work up an appetite before sitting down for stuffing on Thursday, a fun run at Lake Leatherwood Park west of Eureka Springs may be just the ticket. Peter Hackley of the Grassy Knob Fire Department says the run will take place at 8:30 Thursday morning on the trails at the park.
It was organized 3 years ago as a birthday present for Don Gammy, who it's named after, who was an avid runner all of his life, and he was celebrating his 80th birthday. So that's all it is. It's a fun family sort of a thing. There's a 5K trail run, and then there's a fairly level trail, which can be for people just like to walk. It's about a mile long.
Hackley says there are about 115 people already registered for the event, and a few additional people will likely show up the day of the event. Registration is $10 for children, 12 and under, and $15 for adults. Tyson Foods of Springdale reported its fourth quarter earnings earlier today. According to thecitywire.com, the meat processing giant posted $185 million in net income for the quarter, which ended September 30th. That represents a 90.7% improvement over income of $97 million from the same period last year. Although net income increased for the quarter, revenue fell to $8.37 billion for this quarter from nearly $8.5 billion from the same time last year. But the company reported earning $1.58 per share for the full fiscal year, generating full-year revenue of $33.27 billion. In early trading, Tyson stock has gone up nearly 7.6%. Senator Mark Pryor is dissatisfied with a recent Environmental Protection Agency decision. Friday, Senator Pryor issued a statement regarding EPA Administrator Lisa Jackson's decision to deny the state's request for a renewable fuel standard waiver. Governor Mike Beebe asked the EPA in August to waive the mandated volumetric standard for renewable fuel. The governor's request was based on low corn yields caused by the drought that affected all of the state throughout the summer. According to his statement, Senator Pryor disagrees with the EPA's claim that the waiver will have no impact on the state. He also says the decision will not only cause economic harm for livestock and poultry producers, but it will also negatively impact consumers and food manufacturers. The Razorback volleyball team was victorious over the weekend. Friday, the team defeated Georgia at Barnhill Arena in four sets, making the win the team's first 20th season victory since 2005. The team kept the steam into its match against Ole Miss on Sunday. The Razorbacks won in four sets, improving the team's record to 21-8 overall and 12-6 in SEC play. Though the weekend matches marked the end of the team's home season, the Razorbacks finished the regular season on the road this weekend against LSU and South Carolina. In cross-country action, both the Razorback men's and women's cross-country teams competed in the NCAA Division I Championships in Louisville, Kentucky, Saturday. The 11th-ranked men's team finished 10th overall. It is the team's 33rd top-10 finish in program history. The women's cross-country team placed 18th overall in the competition, finishing ahead of Florida, Vanderbilt, and Georgia, the only other SEC women's cross-country teams in the competition. And the 23rd-ranked Arkansas swimming and diving team made a splash during the Houston Cougar Swimming and Diving Invitational. The three-day meet ended Saturday, and the Razorbacks finished ahead of 14 schools, including number 17 LSU, but was bested by 4th-ranked Texas A&M. On the way to the team's stellar performance, team members broke 6 school records, including records in the 100 and 200-meter backstroke events, the 100-meter breaststroke, the 200 and 400-meter medley relay, and in the 400-meter freestyle relay. The team returns to the pool January 12th as it faces Penn State and Missouri State at the Arkansas Natatorium in Fayetteville. Tonight's weather forecast calls for mostly cloudy conditions with a low of 43 in northwest Arkansas and a low of 48 degrees in the Arkansas River Valley. Tomorrow, expect partly cloudy skies with a low in the lower 70s. And tomorrow night, expect clear skies with a low of 37 degrees in northwest Arkansas and a low of 43 degrees in the Arkansas River Valley.
I'm Roby Brock with your Talk Business Update, a recap of the biggest business and political headlines of the last week. Representative Davey Carter won a majority of votes from incoming House members of the 89th General Assembly to become the first Republican House Speaker-elect since Reconstruction. Carter, a Cabot banker and lawyer, presented himself as an alternative leader to fellow Republican Representative Terry Rice after the GOP won 51 seats to take the majority in the recent November elections. In March, current House members chose Representative Darren Williams of Little Rock as Speaker-elect, but his selection was challenged and he did not receive enough votes to keep the seat. Carter defeated Rice in a dramatic and contentious vote by a 52-45 margin. Governor Mike Beebe's balanced budget proposal calls for a near elimination of the food tax based on a trigger mechanism tied to revenue growth. The governor's $4.9 billion proposal for the next fiscal year calls for an upward revision of 2.1% to the current year's forecast, which would bring in an expected $99.5 million in additional funding. Beebe also proposed a 2% cost of living adjustment increase for state employees outside of higher education, and the use of $140 million over 2 years in surplus funding to partially close a Medicaid gap. His proposal to reduce the food tax by nearly 1.5% would be achieved if obligations for desegregation expenses declined or certain state bond payment obligations were met. Retail behemoth Walmart reported third quarter earnings increases of nearly 9% as steady growth across its three major divisions boosted sales and profits. The Bentonville-based retailer reported quarterly sales of more than $113 billion. That's up from $109.5 billion 1 year ago. The 3.4% rise in sales was driven more heavily from increases in U.S. sales and Sam's Club sales, up 3.6% and 4.7% respectively. International sales rose 3.4% compared to 1 year ago. Also, third quarter sales at U.S. Walmart stores open at least a year and excluding fuel increased by 1.5%. Dassault Falcon, which has major jet finishing operations in Little Rock, disclosed that it will establish a wholly owned foreign entity to represent the Falcon brand in China. The Chinese market is one of the fastest growing areas for Dassault in its high-end aviation business. The expansion in China is going to be focused on maintenance and customer service, and is not expected to impact the firm's Little Rock manufacturing operations. With October's monthly report, Electronic Games of Skill wagering at Arkansas's two racetracks and casinos cleared $2.25 billion as the calendar year heads into the home stretch. EGS wagers include gambling spent on video blackjack, poker, slot machines, and other casino-style games. For the month of October, Oaklawn showed $75 million in those wagers, bringing year-to-date totals to almost $786 million. At Southland, EGS wagers topped $143 million for the month, and year-to-date totals hit $1.47 billion. I'm Roby Brock, and that is your Talk Business Update.
This is Ozarks at Large. Boonville, Arkansas has a population of just over 4,000. In 2011, they were a Volunteer Community of the Year. In the early 20th century, Boonville was one of few towns in the nation to house a tuberculosis sanatorium. Today, that same location is home to many individuals, but through the Boonville Human Development Center. The clients make more than 600 rugs a year through the organization's Rugs Project. The rugs are sold at craft fairs across the region. Ozarks at Large's Christina Thomas takes us there.
In the year 1910, a steel banner connected two large rock posts at the bottom of a drive. It read, Arkansas Tuberculosis Sanatorium. Back then, there was no cure for TB, and passing through this gate was a death sentence. Between 1910 and the early 1970s, over 70,000 patients moved through these brown, native rock columns. Patients were kept isolated from the rest of society. This Boonville location was ideal because it was up in the hilly woods. The sanatorium ran like a mini city, complete with a hospital, fire department, freestanding homes, and a school.
This building was built by the Masons in Arkansas.
That's John Carter, a residential services manager for the Boonville Human Development Center, or the BHDC.
To house the children on the tuberculosis sanatorium grounds. So this was a school for children. You'll see a stage in the weaving room where they would have school plays and things like that. So this was a very interesting building and with a lot of history, I think.
When a cure for TB was found in the early 1970s, the sanatorium closed. It didn't take long for the BHDC to find a use for the property, moving in their first patient in 1972. The location now serves as a home and training facility for developmentally disabled adults, one in five state-run centers in Arkansas. Debbie Hill is a rehabilitation instructor supervisor.
It's just providing ways to help them grow and become as much as they can be, no matter whatever the disability might be.
Disabilities include various developmental issues and psychological, including bipolar disorder and schizophrenia. Patients or clients come here for a variety of reasons. Perhaps their behavioral issues are too difficult for families to handle, or the families themselves are aging and are no longer physically able to care for their loved ones. Debbie has been with BHDC for 25 years, though when she started as a temporary teaching assistant, she thought she'd only be here 6 months. She says she got hooked on the clients.
And 25 years later, I'm going, why am I still here? And they're why I'm still here, because I do enjoy working with them. I mean, any time it can be stressful or it can be a little tense and stuff, but overall, they're a lot of fun. They're great people. I enjoy working with them. I used to make the mistake of saying anybody could work here. You know, I mean, it's a piece of cake. Anybody could work here. But not everybody can, and not everybody should.
Debbie now works in the Masonic building we mentioned earlier. It is in this former school building where the Rugs Project takes place, a pre-vocational training program the BDHC has been doing for 30 years. About 35 clients work here Monday through Friday. They have a literal job to do, making rugs.
It's not necessarily a job per se that they can go out in the community and do, but it's learning how to work with others. It's learning how to get along. This may not be your best friend, but I have to work with them and I have to show them respect as they show me respect. Learning how to do a task and to follow through and to stay on task, you know, during that work period, and knowing when to take your breaks and things. So all part of it is kind of work ethics that you need to learn in order to have a job outside of this facility.
The rugs they make here are pretty nice, sold to the public.
More on that in a bit. They are made from loopers, as Debbie calls them. She had to explain further. When the toe of a sock is sewn together, there is excess fabric that has to be cut off. The result is a sock loop, a circle of material about 2 inches long. A sock factory in Fort Payne, Alabama, gives them to the BHDC Rugs Project. They only have to pay for the shipping. There are many steps involved in rug making. Clients receive individualized care and attention to find which job is right for them.
We sit down, we give one-on-one instruction on how to do a task, and then we back off and kind of let them do it. And we set the objective based on, are they easily distracted? You know, is it maybe just staying attentive, you know, staying on task? And we'll work on those things, things that will help them develop longer period of times of being able to focus on what they're doing at the moment. We help them also by, you know, not, I mean, you know, we might try and take away some of the distractions. If they're distracted and look out a window, maybe we could move their workspace a little way. So we find different ways that will help them be successful. But we base it on what they can already do. And then we sit down and we show them and help teach them how to do the things that we want them to do.
Groups of workers are set up in the former classrooms. The BHDC also does recycling, picking up paper and cardboard from local schools. So some clients are tearing and sorting magazines. In one classroom, others are sorting the loopers, picking the bad ones out. They get paid for the work that they do, paid by the pound of sock loops they sort. Today, they are working with nylon loops, like from pantyhose. Other workers are tying the loops together to form long chains. Debbie explains.
And he's double tying. Because of it being nylon, it's kind of thin. And so we figured with double tie, then we'd have a much thicker and it'd be easier to weave and make a much nicer rug.
So it has two loops put together.
Yeah.
Instead of one.
So he takes two loops at a time and loops them and ties them into the other one, makes a long chain, and then rolls that up into a ball so that it can go to the weavers, and then they weave it. And so we'll show you how to do that here in a little bit. But they're cleaning and sorting loops right now, and he's tearing paper for the recycling.
We move to a room across the hall. While the nylon loops are all white, they also make colorful chains, resulting in colorful rugs. The staff dye the sock loops to make a rainbow of circles. Sometimes the workers like to make their own patterns when tying loops into a chain, causing the pattern of a rug to be a bit off. To make sure there's an even distribution of color, the staff lay out colored loops in boxes on a circular table. Workers go around the table, picking up a loop from each box, stacking it on a stick.
So when he gets a stick, and these are the old wood slats off of the wood blinds that used to be here when it was a sanatorium. We found a good use for the wood slats, so we take them and we use them then for sticks for them to stack the colored loops on. That way they can keep them in order.
Workers then take the loops from the stick and tie them into the chains. When it's a good-sized chain, it's rolled into a ball and taken into the weaving room. Not everyone is a weaver. It takes some serious skill. Only 8 out of 35 weave. I was somewhat shocked to see that they use full-sized looms. About 8 light-colored wooden ones are set up in one half of a large, light room. They face a stage. That's back wall is painted with a bright and colorful animal mural. One of the weavers took the time to show me how a rug is made.
What's your name?
I'm Chrissy.
Chrissy, my name's Christina.
That's a pretty name.
It's close.
All right, this is the stick, and you put the colors on here and everything, and then you go and you go and put it through like this, and then you do like that, and then you you change feet and stuff, and you go.
Chrissy
like
is moving
again,
a boat of sorts in between two rows of string. When the chain gets to the other side, she pulls back on an arm, securing the sock rope to the ones before it. Moving her feet on pedals flips the string so that she can move her colorful chain back through to the other side. And the process continues until the rug is the appropriate size. Staff members finish the edges. Of course, you can buy rugs at the BHDC, but you can also get one at one of the many craft fairs in the region. Staff take the rugs and set up shop at places like Spanker Creek and Bella Vista, bringing in over $8,000 just last month. It helps to fund the Rugs Project and to pay the workers. These rugs are popular. They get custom orders, and I've had two on my kitchen floor for the last year.
And of course, they get excited, and when they hear all the praise about their rugs, they like being told what a good job they do and how many rugs we sell. They all go around with puffed up chests, you know, all right. But it makes it nice for them to know they are capable of making something that other people want and are willing to pay for and buy, you know, and so that's encouraging for them.
Another weaver, Harold, was willing to talk to me.
Do you like your job now?
Yeah.
What do you like about it?
I love it.
For Ozarks at Large, I'm Christina Thomas.
For more information on the Rugs Project and the Boonville Human Development Center, you can contact Debbie Hill at Deborah, that's D-E-B-O-R-A-H, hill@arkansas.gov.
Claude Debussy briefly tried painting, but in the end, he said brushstrokes could only capture a moment. Music, he said, could mimic the shifting, glinting, undulating nature of light and waves. The New York Philharmonic plays Debussy's musical Portrait of the Sea, La Mer, in concert on Monday's Performance Today from 8 p.m.
Performance Today, tonight at 8, here on KUAF 91.3 FM.
150 years ago, on November 28, 1862, Confederate General John Sappington Marmaduke's 2,000-man cavalry division was gathering supplies at Cane Hill in northwest Arkansas when the Kansas Division of the Union Army of the Frontier attacked with 5,000 soldiers and 30 cannons. The rebels fell back into the Boston Mountains, setting up several defensive lines as they moved their supplies toward Fort Smith. The fight at Cane Hill lasted 9 hours and covered 12 miles of the rugged Boston Mountains before ending at nightfall. Marmaduke reported, "It has been a hard day's work," while Union Commander James Blunt crowed that he thrashed him out of his boots and breeches. The Yankees returned to Cane Hill, setting the stage for the Battle of Prairie Grove 9 days later. To learn more about Arkansas history and the 150th anniversary of the American Civil War, visit ArkansasCivilWar150.com. The Arkansas Civil War Sesquicentennial Commission is an agency of the Department of Arkansas Heritage. I'm Mark Crist.
It's Monday, November 19th, 2012, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda, and joining me now is Becca Martin-Brown, Features Editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
This almost never happens anymore.
What's that?
Just one recommendation for tonight.
Only one?
Only one.
Okay.
But there's things like the lights of the Ozarks and the lights on the Bentonville Square.
Ongoing events.
Ongoing events.
Yes.
But tonight, Jim Greason has a documentary that's showing at the Fayetteville Public Library at 6:15.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Conlon Noncaro, Virtuoso of the Player Piano.
Yes, it should be fascinating.
I cannot imagine anything more interesting than the concept of being a virtuoso of the player piano. It is at 6:15 and it is free.
Excellent. Well, I know where people will be. Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin-Brown is Features Editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Oh, everybody tell me how do you do? Everybody tell me how you do. These gangbiz boys come out to welcome you.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
I don't care where you go, how long you stay. Well, good countryman, bring you back someday. But someday, baby, won't trouble my mind anymore.
The CD Keep It to Yourself, Arkansas Blues Volume 1, Solo Performances, was released in late 2004. It's a reissue of a 1983 LP on Rooster Blues Records of Chicago. The re-release came about with the help of Helena's Delta Cultural Center, part of the Department of Arkansas Heritage. The songs came from 1976 recordings made by the University of Arkansas at Pine Bluff's Arkansas Blues Project, funded by a bicentennial grant. More than 9 hours of music were recorded at 17 sessions at different Arkansas towns by Jim O'Neill and Louis Guida. W.C. Clay, heard here, was recorded in May 1976 in Elaine. With 6 songs, Clay is the best represented performer on Keep It to Yourself. He opens and closes the album. W.C. Clay died in Phillips County in 1979.
Hello, Central. Will you please give me tonight?
Helena-born Herbert Wilson was recorded at the White Swan Cafe in his hometown the same month. Wilson is heard here doing the Lightnin' Hopkins song, Hello Central. Herbert Wilson later moved from Arkansas and died in 1998.
I want to talk to my baby. Oh, Lord, gee, we're down the line. John Henry had a little woman. Dress she wore was red. Last word that I heard him say, I'm gone while the woman fell dead.
Willie Wright, heard here, was born 1926 in Macon, Georgia, and settled in Little Rock as an adult and performed with harmonica player Sonny Blair. Willie Wright was reportedly a King Biscuit Time sideman briefly in the 1950s. He was recorded in Sweet Home near Little Rock in April 1976. Wright recorded this old-time march on guitar in June 1976 in Winchester. The Louisiana native was born in 1909 just south of Eudora and was the oldest musician recorded for the UAPB Arkansas Blues Project. Mack Wright spent most of his life in southeastern Arkansas, where he died in 1987. Cedell Davis became the best known of the musicians recorded for the project and album. Davis's upside-down butterknife slide guitar playing is well documented, with recordings of Davis playing harmonica, like he does here with the Big G Boogie on the Keep It To Yourself album, are lesser known. Born in Helena in 1926, Cedell Davis later recorded for L&R Records of West Germany. In the 1990s, Cedell Davis lived in Pine Bluff and recorded albums for Fat Possum of Oxford, Mississippi, and Capricorn, one produced by Little Rock native Robert Palmer. A 2002 Cedell Davis album, produced by Little Rock native Joe Cripps, featured members of The Minus Five, Screaming Trees, and R.E.M.
You know I need you, baby. I need you here by my side.
Born 1925 in Clarksdale, Mississippi, Willie Moore moved with his family to Helena when he was 15. 10 years later, Moore was sentenced to Cummins Prison, where he spent 15 years. Afterwards, Willie Moore moved to the Pine Bluff area. Moore recorded Willie's Blues in April 1976 at the Jungle Hut in Pine Bluff. Nelson Carson, heard here, was born 1917 in Texas. He moved to the Ashdown, Texarkana area when he was 21 and recorded as a guitarist in the 1950s. He died in Ashdown in 2003. Pianist Trenton Cooper, heard here, was born 1923 in Hope. In the 1950s, Cooper toured with R&B legend Jimmy Liggins and his Drops of Joy. Cooper was director of the UAPB Cooperative Education Office when the Fishtail theme, heard here, was recorded in Pine Bluff in June 1976. Cooper later recorded an album for the Wolf label of Austria. Trenton Cooper died in his native Arkansas in 2001. Riola Jackson was the only female, the only a cappella singer, and the only Little Rock native to appear on Keep It To Yourself. Born in 1949, she was more than 15 years younger than the next youngest musician who appeared on the album. Recorded at the Women's Unit of Cummins Prison, Jackson was also the only inmate of the Arkansas Department of Correction on the Keep It To Yourself album. Here in its entirety is Riola Jackson of Little Rock with I'll Take Care of You. It's a Bobby Blue Bland cover song recorded in March 1976, at Cummins Prison for UAPB's Arkansas Blues Project.
I know you've been hurt by someone else. I can tell by the way that you carry yourself. But if you let me, here's what I'll do. I'll take care of you. I love and lost the same as you. So you know just what that I'm going through. But if you let me, here's what I'll do. I'll take care of you. You don't ever have to worry. You don't ever have to cry. I'll be right there beside you to dry your weeping eyes. So, darling, tell me that you'll be true and no more worries that you'll go through. But if you let me, here's what I'll do. I'll take care of you.
Little Rock native Riola Jackson with I'll Take Care of You. It's from the 1983 album Keep It to Yourself, Arkansas Blues, Volume 1, Solo Performances, reissued in 2004 with the help of Helena's Delta Cultural Center. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Arkansongs is a production of FM 89 and Experiment Station Studios. For more information, visit arkansongs.org.
This is Ozarks at Large. The lighting of the Fayetteville downtown square kicked off on Saturday with the Fayetteville Unites with Holiday Lights Parade. Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis collected sounds from the event and has this report.
Let's turn on the lights. You ready? Let's count it down from 10. Are you ready? Here we go. 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Singing club singing.
We need some Christmas tunes.
Last month, an iconic figure of several social justice movements in the United States during the 1960s and 1970s visited Little Rock to support new research efforts by UALR's Institute on Race and Ethnicity. The Institute has assembled a diverse group of people throughout the state who are all dedicated to making constructive changes to Arkansas's criminal justice system. Malcolm Glover from our content partner KUAR in Little Rock has the story.
Crowds of people stood in long lines and later packed into the University Theater on UALR's campus to listen to a lecture by longtime social activist, author, and educator, Dr. Angela Davis. For over an hour, Davis talked about her life and work.
Thank you. First of all, thank you for the wonderful welcome and good evening.
Davis specifically focused her remarks on racial disparities with respect to the death penalty, life sentences, and life sentences without parole.
And I want to tell you, first of all, that I encountered the reality of the death penalty many years ago when I myself was in jail. I was fortunate enough not only to be acquitted, but I was fortunate that the state of California temporarily abolished the death sentence in 1972. Because I was in jail without bail, because I was charged with three capital crimes, I had not foreseen the possibility of being released before my trial took place. The Supreme Court ruled again that previously capital offenses would remain non-bailable. So if I hadn't gotten out when I did, precisely at that moment, I might still be in jail today, and I might not be with you this evening.
She made sure to note the various injustices that exist due to mass incarceration.
The function of freedom is to free somebody else. And not just another member of our family or a member of what we consider to be our community, but rather members of our universe, members with different racial ancestries, members with different gender identifications, different sexual orientations, different nationalities. And maybe I first became aware that we were facing a major problem with the structures and institutions of incarceration when I myself was in jail. And at that time, young people throughout the country were involved in many movements to free political prisoners, including members of the Black Panther Party, the Soledad Brothers, Lolita Lebron, and the Puerto Rican political prisoners. And many of us realized that it wasn't simply a question of political repression, but that the institution of the prison was itself racist and repressive. 25% of the world's incarcerated population lives in jails and prisons in the United States of America, whereas we constitute only 5% of the planet's population. Now, something is wrong with that. And how is it that this country can continue to call itself the model for democracy in the world? Imagine the state of Arkansas leading the country in terms of addressing the role that racism plays in producing such mass incarceration that we now call the United States of America a prison nation.
Davis rarely gives interviews, but following her remarks, she talked with KUAR News about her work and hopes for the country's future. Dr. Davis, I'm wondering if you feel as though there is a difference in the Angela Davis who is ingrained in so many people's memories from when you started getting involved in social activism to the Dr. Angela Davis of today. What, if anything, has changed and what has stayed the same?
Well, I'm just trying to do what I've always tried to do, and that is to help deepen people's consciousness, to convey the message that we're all in this together and that we have to take responsibility as a community to make changes in the world. I never saw myself as the narrative that was built up around me. I know that it was important to create a story for a campaign, but I always realized that I was who I am, right? I wasn't who other people imagined me to be. You know, oftentimes today people come up to me who are my age or so, and they tell me how awed they are to be able to meet me, and then they begin to talk about what it was like back then. And I always make the point that through me, people remember their own youth. People remember their own activism. And they remember what it felt like when we thought we could really change the world. And I'm happy. I'm happy to be that vehicle. But at the same time, I'm more than that. I am who I am. And I have to, you know, try to continue to do the work that I believe is important.
Dr. Davis says she has a lot of hope for this new generation of activists that's making a difference.
It's much more difficult now to build and sustain movements than it was 40 years ago or during the 1930s. It's because we know so much more. Our ideas are so much more complicated. You know, they're back in the 60s, we didn't talk about gender. We didn't talk about sexuality. We didn't talk about disability. We didn't talk about the environment. We didn't talk about food politics. We didn't talk about ableism. You know, now we have to figure out how to pull all of these things together and how to be attentive to the complexity of the political arenas within which we work. I think that young people are much better at that sometimes than older people, than those of us who had to learn how to do it from scratch. Because in many ways, it's given to the younger activists. That is where they start, and they will have to go somewhere else. I have a lot of hope. As I said before, I think that Occupy era was an indication of what's possible. It made it possible to talk about the economy in ways that we have not done in my entire lifetime. To talk about capitalism was always assumed to be the work only of communists who were considered to be people who should be exiled. And so now we can't actually talk about capitalism. And that's good. That's important. If the Occupy campaign or movement achieved nothing other than that, it means that it helped to change the political landscape in this country.
Dr. Davis, from your experience working with different social change movements, what still needs to happen here in the United States?
Well, you know, sometimes we think we know where we need to go, and we discover in the process that there's so much more that needs to be done, so much that we have to rethink our goals. And in a sense, I've come to the conclusion that that is the process of freedom. It's not one thing. It's not one place. It's not one time. It's an infinite process of uncovering aspects of ourselves and our communities that we couldn't have possibly imagined before. Without the Black movement, the women's movement would have been inconceivable. The gay movement, you know, all of these movements, and those who became involved in the movement for Black freedom had no idea that they were opening up a whole new world for so many people, like literally all over the world. And to me, that's what's exciting about being involved in movements for social change. We may think we know where we want to go, but then we discover that, now is the time to look a bit further, to go a bit higher. And I think that's the nature of the universe.
Dr. Angela Davis says she'll continue devoting her life to social justice causes. And as a founding member of the national organization Critical Resistance, Davis says she's dedicated to dismantling what she calls the prison industrial complex by focusing on programs and services that educate the masses, reform offenders, and transform communities. In Little Rock, I'm Malcolm Glover.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda, and joining me now in Studio 123 is Kyle Kellums, because
it's time to give away tickets to Billy Elliot.
Yes. And you asked this question on Friday, so I thought it was only fitting that you stopped by to give the answer.
Yes. The question is, of all the state capitals, all 50 state capitals, there is only one that borders another country.
Mm-hmm.
And we asked people to send us the correct answer at ozarksatlarge@gmail.com.
Mm-hmm.
More than 24 people did.
Yes.
The answer is Juneau, Alaska.
There you go. Which I had a tough time with. I don't think about that.
Well, and yeah, I think people who looked it up, we had a couple of people who thought it might be in Washington,
right,
or Detroit, but no, Juneau, mm-hmm, Alaska.
Okay, so we have the names in Ceramic Cow. You're,
yes,
drawing a winner.
Yes, so out of all, and this is for 2 Billy Elliot tickets, 4 movie tickets, any Malco Movie Area Theater, and a Tim Ernst calendar,
mm-hmm,
we'll send you the Malco tickets and the calendar in the mail.
Yep.
Billy Elliot tickets at Will Call at Walton Arts Center.
Yes.
Margaret Buchanan Selassie.
Congratulations.
Congratulations.
We will email you and get your information, and thanks,
right,
for listening.
We're going to have another one of those packages to give away in a few days,
mm-hmm,
the same way. So stay tuned. If you didn't win the Billy Elliot tickets this time, you still have another chance to win 2 more.
Thanks, Kyle.
Thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 19th of November, 2012. It's the birthday of the poet Sharon Olds, born in San Francisco, 1942, the jazz trombonist Tommy Dorsey, born in Shenandoah, Pennsylvania, 1905. The poet Alan Tate, born in Winchester, Kentucky, 1899. He was working at a True Stories magazine as a copy editor, got fired, rented a farmhouse upstate New York, and wrote his best-known poem, Ode to the Confederate Dead. And it was on this day, 1863, President Abraham Lincoln got up in front of about 15,000 people at the new National Cemetery in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, and delivered his address. It was a foggy, cold morning. Lincoln got there about 10 o'clock. Around noon, the sun came out, crowds gathering on a hill, military band played. The headline orator, Edward Everett, spoke for more than 2 hours, describing the Battle of Gettysburg in great detail. And when he was finished, Lincoln got up, pulled his speech from his coat pocket, and read it. It was about 10 sentences, about 272 words. Didn't mention the war or the battle, didn't mention the North or the South or slavery. Simply said that the nation was founded on the idea that all men are created equal and that we must fight for that principle in honor of those who have died fighting for it. The audience was distracted by a photographer who was setting up his camera, And by the time Lincoln finished and sat down, a lot of people didn't even realize he had spoken. But the speech was reprinted in newspapers around the country. Everett's speech in print was wordy and pretentious. Lincoln's was elegant and concise, and that's the one that we remember. Here's a poem for today by Louise Erdrich, entitled Advice to Myself. Leave the dishes, let the celery rot in the bottom drawer of the refrigerator, and an earthen scum harden on the kitchen floor. Leave the black crumbs in the bottom of the toaster. Throw the cracked bowl out and don't patch the cup. Don't patch anything. Don't mend. Buy safety pins. Don't even sew on a button. Let the wind have its way, then the earth it invades as dust, and then the dead foaming up in gray rolls underneath the couch. Talk to them. Tell them they are welcome. Don't keep all the pieces of the puzzles or the doll's tiny shoes in pairs. Don't worry who uses whose toothbrush or if anything matches at all, except one word to another or a thought. Pursue the authentic. Decide first what is authentic, then go after it with all your heart. Your heart, that place you don't even think of cleaning out, that closet stuffed with savage mementos. Don't sort the paper clips from screws, from saved baby teeth, or worry if we're all eating cereal for dinner again. Don't answer the telephone, ever, or weep over anything at all that breaks. Pink molds will grow within those sealed cartons in the refrigerator, except new forms of life, and talk to the dead who drift in through the screened windows, who collect patiently on the tops of food jars and books. Recycle the mail. Don't read it. Don't read anything except what destroys the insulation between yourself and your experience, or what pulls down, or what strikes at, or what shatters this ruse you call necessity. Advice to Myself, a poem by Louise Erdrich, from her collection Original Fire, published by HarperCollins, used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Goddard College, offering low residency bachelor's and master's of fine arts degrees in creative writing. More at goddard.edu. Written by Joy Biles, produced by Kathy Roach. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
The University of Arkansas Fort Smith's 32nd season of entertainment presents Season Greetings Tuesday, November 27th at 7 p.m. at the Stubblefield Center. This concert features holiday classics by the symphonic band, choral ensembles, jazz cats, and special guests. Tickets and more information are available at uafs.edu. A listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas, this is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Lowell. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Thanks so much for listening. Tune in tomorrow at noon for an all-new edition of Ozarks at Large. I will be back along with my co-host, Kyle Kellums. Thanks again for listening, and I hope your week is off to a fantastic start.